our metabolic and our physiologic response to stress is the same at the cellular level, regardless of what's causing the stress to start with.
Yeah.
Right? It could be work stress, relationship stress, family stress, physical stress, nutritional stress, environmental stress, toxic exposure stress. But what people don't understand, let's go back to the 1.2 million neurons per eye. Mm. If you can't see fast and use your two eyes together as a well-integrated team, let me just tell you that that is unrelenting visual stress.
Welcome to the Paris Hodges Podcast, a space for conversations rooted in curiosity of these divinely created bodies we've been given and this human experience as a whole. This is a space where we will explore all the complexity and nuance of existing on this spinning rock, while I share story and dialogue with some individuals I consider to be great investigators of our bodies, many of which have had profound impact on my journey and understandings. I'm grateful you are here. Let's dive in. Greetings and hallucinations, beautiful humans. Welcome to episode number one of the Paris Hodges Podcast. My guest today is Dr. Doug Steffi, who I met during my time in the Root Cause Protocol. Dr. Doug isn't like most eye doctors. Most eye doctors limit their practice to the intersection of two circles or areas. One, can you see 20/20? And two, are your eyes healthy? Neurodevelopmental or behavioral optometrists such as Dr. Steffi explore a third circle that's rich with insight into why a person may be struggling to function at maximum capacity. This third circle covers a list of items, including but not limited to retained primitive reflexes, millisecond timing clock, visual vestibular interactions, eye teaming, eye focusing, eye tracking, visual auditory integration, working memory, visual aspects of dyslexia and reading disorders, etc. Deficiencies or weaknesses in one or more of these areas can cause or contribute to many issues, including ADHD, Alzheimer's, autism, bipolar disorder, clumsiness, dyslexia, fatigue, fibromyalgia, headaches and migraines, mood swings, speech delays, traumatic brain injury. In other words, our visual cortex plays quite an important role in our ability to thrive in our bodies. Dr. Doug and I also discuss the role that minerals play in supporting our visual cortex and thus supporting individuals in being able to thrive and function optimally. I hope you enjoy this episode. Let's go ahead and dive in. Dr. Doug, it is so wonderful to have you here. Thank you for joining me. You are my first guest of this iteration of conversations. Woo-hoo. Yay. So excited. And we met during our time doing the Root Cause Protocol consultant training. And I would love for you to share a little bit about yourself and your journey. And we'll dive into some really good stuff.
Well, my primary training is that I am an optometrist. And as we carry on our conversation today, your listeners will start to appreciate that there's a whole lot more to vision, body, and brain than just having healthy eyes or seeing 20/20. Mm. Which is really the message I want to convey today, that there's a whole lot more going on. And interestingly enough, I also have a master's degree in education, and I've got trained years ago in a bunch of different ways to teach reading. And I've intersected with school districts for a number of years. And I am so lucky to get to do what I do because I love going to work every day. Mm. It is so much fun.
Living the dream.
Well, yeah, I like what I do. And it's wonderful to be able to share this kind of optometry with my fellow human beings because, you know, you can have a history of migraine or motion sickness or be clumsy or be told that you're ADD or inattentive ADD or dyslexia, dyspraxia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, oppositional defiant. There's a lot of labels that people are given behaviorally when frequently at the root of it is some dysfunction in vision. Mm. And because there were colleagues of mine back in the 50s that did a bunch of research with a pediatrician at Yale, and there's an expression that came out of that, which is, if you want to understand the whole child, you have to understand their visual system.
Mm.
And if you want to understand their visual system, you have to understand the whole child. And the reason that's important, right, is because optometrists that practice this way, we don't just look at, you've got two eyeballs stuck in your head. We want to understand more about your brain, more about your body, more about primitive reflexes, more about your gut and your microbiome, more about how your body's regulating minerals.
Yeah.
And we want to look at you in its totality.
Yeah. No, it's a really beautiful way to look at the whole system, the ecosystem of the body, which I think is so important, which really lended to a lot of our conversations that organically came up because in my childhood, I was diagnosed with scotopic sensitivity, which is something that not many people are too aware of, but basically, and I'll let you better explain this, but my eyes are, what's the word that you use? Assaulted by the white background with the black lettering. And it's a form of dyslexia that becomes really challenging to read over time. And I struggled a lot as a child in reading out loud or being able to actually like take the time to like pause and read, and thus continually labeled myself as unintelligent. When realistically, you know, when with the understanding you and I now have too, with the combination of minerals and then what our brains are doing with our visual cortex.
Well, as an example, there's estimated to be 3 million sensory neurons that feed information to the brain.
Mm. Just a few.
Classically, vision, auditory, taste, touch, and smell. Mm. And of that 3 million, there's estimated to be 30,000 auditory neurons per ear and 1.2 million per eye.
Wow.
And then if that's not crazy enough, you know the expression, you can't put a square peg in a round hole?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, imagine that your right eye is the square peg and your left eye is the round hole. And that your brain has to slot your two eyes together and make them work together as a perfectly synchronized team. So if you look to the right or the left, up, down, in, out, the two eyes in the head should be moving as a perfectly synchronized team. And there's a whole lot of people whose eyes are not moving together in that manner.
Yeah.
And simplistically, we refer to that as a binocular vision disorder. Namely, in lay terms, your two eyes don't work together as a fast, accurate, effortless, sustainable, well-integrated team.
Mm.
Somewhat connected to that is this idea of the magnocellular visual system, which is about motion processing. And motion processing is usually referred to as the where visual pathway, and then there's the what pathway, right? Well, before you can figure out what it is that you're looking at, you've got to be able to figure out where to look, when to look, and how long to look for. And the big ticket items where it does feel like your brain and body is being physically assaulted by light is bright sunlight and glare, lights when they flicker, frequently motion in our peripheral vision, and regular repeating patterns, which that's what print is. Print is alternating black and white stripes.
Yeah.
And arguably, someone knew a little bit about your visual skills issues to give you that label, but that label isn't enough.
It wasn't.
No, we need to get to the core of what's happening at the different root cause of what leads to that outcome where black and white stripes, like print, is, and you know, and you've lived it, but it's not enough to say that it's visually irritating. I do think that language like being physically assaulted by print is a really a better way to describe it.
Yeah.
Because someone who has these visual skills deficits, it's almost like somebody sprayed visual repellent over a page of print. So no matter how much your thinking brain says to itself, I want to read this, your visual brain is like, we're not doing that.
Yeah.
We're not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many years ago it was, but a number of years ago, one of the experiences I had with a patient, I have a pattern of black and white stripes that is published by a psychologist out of the UK named Arnold Wilkins. He's been publishing about this for more than 30 years. And that pattern of black and white stripes is designed to be super annoying if your visual system and brain is functioning in this manner, right?
Yeah.
So in fact, it can be so disturbing that he actually felt compelled to write a one sentence warning on it that says, hey, don't look at this if you have a history of epilepsy or migraine. Now, I've been using this pattern for 20 years or longer, and I've not ever knowingly triggered a migraine when we're in the office, but I have a lot of people that have a migraine history or watered down versions of that find that pattern really annoying to look at. So I first established a baseline is, do these black and white stripes bother you? Is it comfortable or uncomfortable to look at these stripes? Oh, it's uncomfortable. And do the lines hold still, or do they wiggle, move, vibrate, pulsate? Do you start to perceive different shapes that are morphing within the pattern of stripes, and or do you see any colors?
Yeah.
All right. So any or all of that is likely to be true. And then I'll pull out a book. And one of the books that I have in the office that I frequently pull out, I've now put a sticky note in there so that I open it up to these two pages, because the page on the right is one giant table with some words and numbers and figures, but it's mostly a blank page. And then the left-hand page is three paragraphs of black and white stripes, because it's all text. So what I've learned now is when somebody finds a black and white stripe pattern annoying, pull out this book, open up these two pages, and my questioning goes like this. Hey, when I first hand this book to you, which page do you want to look at first? And many people will say the one on the right. Mm. I'm like, well, given what you've just learned about the black and white stripe pattern, why do you think that would be true? And frequently they'll say, well, there's less black and white stripes. Yeah, you're avoiding looking at the left-hand page. And they're like, oh, I guess I am. I'm like, okay, but I want you to make yourself look at the left-hand page now. And I said, I'm gonna ask you a new question. Nobody's ever asked you before. I'm absolutely convinced of it. And you've never thought about it. You've never thought about this, but I'm asking you, when you look at the left-hand page, do you really want to look at the words and letters or the white spaces around and between the words and letters?
Mm.
And they'll think about that for about a millisecond. And then they'll say, I'm looking at the white spaces. So, I'm like, well, if your visual brain is busy avoiding looking at the words and letters on the page, do you think that might prevent you become a fast, accurate, fluent reader with good comprehension?
Mm.
If you're busy not looking at the words and letters?
Yeah.
And then in order to get yourself to look at the words and letters, your thinking brain has to allocate cognitive resources and attention to trying to corral your two eyes and make your eyes look at the print itself.
Yeah.
And to the degree that that's true, now your visual skills deficits that you didn't even know you had, right? Because you went to the other eye doctor last week and you were told that you see 20/20 and everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the two circle Venn diagram of the way most eye doctors practice, which is one circle is 20/20 and the other is your eyes healthy. When they tell you that everything's fine, I wish they would just say, well, everything's fine in the two circles that I am measuring within.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to do anything to measure whether or not you've got skills deficits in this third circle.
And then just talk about too, the mineral deficiencies that are related to it all.
Well, not the least of which is certainly what we learned in the mineral course is that our metabolic and our physiologic response to stress is the same at the cellular level, regardless of what's causing the stress to start with.
Yeah.
Right? It could be work stress, relationship stress, family stress, physical stress, nutritional stress, environmental stress, toxic exposure stress. But what people don't understand, let's go back to the 1.2 million neurons per eye.
Mm.
If you can't see fast and use your two eyes together as a well-integrated team, let me just tell you that is unrelenting visual stress.
Yeah.
Which has its own role to play in becoming minerally dysregulated.
Yep, leading to tons of magnesium loss and then the whole shebang that goes downhill.
Right. But yet you can see 20/20 and your eyes are healthy. So what do you mean I have a vision problem?
Yeah.
And then, which then backs me back up to the two circle Venn diagram,
mm-hmm.
20/20 healthy eyes. And then guys like me come along and we say, well, you know, those two circles are important, but, and then if I'm actually drawing this on a piece of paper, I'm like, and I'll draw a third circle in the Venn diagram. And I'll say, well, what about that circle? Did you know that this circle existed? Mm-hmm. They're like, no. 20/20 is the holy grail of going to the eye doctor, right? If you can see 20/20, everything's fine. Again, everything's fine up to the point by which that gets defined. But no, everything is not fine because in the third circle, And here we go. In the third circle, there's eye teaming, eye focusing, eye tracking, motion processing, visual aliasing, millisecond timing clock, archetype movement, primitive reflexes, working memory, executive function, visual spatial, visual attention, processing speed, visual postural, visual auditory integration, visual motor integration. There's a lot of stuff going on in the third circle.
Just a few important things to being able to be a human.
Yeah, it's such a giant big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, by and large, the public doesn't know that what we're talking about even exists.
Yeah. I mean, it's not on anyone's radar. It just so happened, you know, going back to the fact that even I was diagnosed, it was only because my parents worked in this, you know, school district, and with my dad was a special education teacher. So there's a few more resources available to individuals that need more support. And somehow this came up on the radar, just very like arbitrarily. And my younger sister and I happened to be tested for it.
Well, you know, the other interesting thing is, I mean, here we are in 2022. I bought the practice that I'm in 1988. And when I first bought this practice, I was still teaching at the local optometry school. And I always had somebody work for me part-time while I was teaching. And I taught full-time from 85 to 88, bought this practice, taught part-time from 88 to 95, left teaching altogether, and then ran a laser center in 96 and 97, and then decided that I was just going to come back to my practice, and that was going to be me. And so in the winter of 97, I read a book titled Why Our Children Can't Read and What We Can Do About It.
Mm.
And I was so intrigued by what this cognitive psychologist wrote about that I went out and got trained in this reading method called phonographics. Mm. And there's a website called readamerica.net or phono, phono hyphen graphics, graphix.com. That's the method. So in the winter of 97, I read that book and then went and got trained in this reading method. And then I started to add some other testing into my practice to better understand what kids weren't and weren't understanding about our alphabetic writing system, namely a concept called phonological processing. And phonological processing is how speech sounds. Well, let me back up. True. The cleanest way to define phonological processing is our ability to manipulate the spoken sounds in language. Hmm. So simplistically, the most common ways that phonological processing is discussed is blending. So if I say some letter sounds, k, a, t, can you blend them together and say cat? Or if I say, hey, let's do a segmenting task. I'm going to say the word. You have to tell me the individual sounds within the word. So if I say, tell me the sounds that you hear in the word dog, well, if you can segment it, you'll say d-a-g, right? Simple enough. So we've done blending, we've done segmenting. The fancy word for this next one is called elision, or in simple terms, sound manipulation. So if I say the word snail, and say it without the sound, you should be able to take out the sound and then tell me sail. So that's the elision task. So those, granted that those are spoken language tasks, right? But what people don't realize is that there's a modestly robust area of literature that ties visual skills into the development of phonological processing skills. Because it's a lot easier to teach someone about phonological processing if you can anchor those sounds to a concrete symbol, namely letters.
Yeah.
But you've got to have the visual skills in the totality of that third circle to really be able to appreciate those symbols and remember the symbols and have the ability to then map the speech sounds onto the symbols themselves. Well, again, if you're visually or physically or cognitively assaulted by print, you don't easily pick up on those letter symbols and how speech sounds map onto them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So your decoding fluency struggles because you don't see how letters map onto speech sounds with any degree of consistency or fluency. So in this context, even though phonological processing is a spoken language skill, visual skills make teaching phonological processing miles and miles faster.
I could imagine. So let's get into then how this ends up manifesting and how the nervous system is connected with it. Because I know you have some really great descriptions of this all.
Yes. So if you go back to the anatomy, 1.2 million neurons per eye, 30,000 per ear. There's, I have sought out some other information and I came across a Scientific American article maybe written 15 years or so ago. I don't remember, but best I could come up with was 3,000 touch receptors per fingertip and 17,000 touch receptors in our face. But otherwise, I don't know where all the rest of the 3 million nerve fibers come from. I've never been able to find a resource that describes it. But let's go with vision and auditory as our two primary threat detectors, right?
Yeah.
Because our subconscious mind is running this endless loop tape that's asking the question, do I feel safe? And I'm arguing if all of your sensory systems are operating the way that they should, understanding that 2.4 of the 3 million neurons are coming through vision. Vision is our primary sensory modality. Don't kill the messenger. I didn't make up the anatomy.
Right? Shots are going to be fired.
I'm just here social to speak media. The truth of them. So, and as an example, if we were walking down a dark alley in an unfamiliar neighborhood that was a little sketchy, and we saw somebody 50, 80, 100 feet up the street, like hiding behind a dumpster or a light pole, hopefully we would see them and then we'd give them the stare down, like, who are you and what are you up to? And do I still feel safe? Me seeing you, right? So in that regard, when our subconscious mind is asking itself that question, do I feel safe? We are primarily answering that question through visual input, right? If we were in that same dark alley and we heard a noise over to the side, arguably we would turn and look and make that assessment through vision about, am I safe or do I need to prepare for fight or flight? Make sense?
Yep, makes sense.
You don't You don't look at something that's threatening and then think, you know what, in order for you to make that final assessment, I'm actually going to close my eyes or look away and lean in with my ear, and I'm going to use my auditory system to make that final threat assessment. We don't do that. It's vision. It's all about vision.
Yeah.
So if we can't use vision fast enough, accurately enough, effortlessly enough, and sustainably over time, our subconscious mind really struggles to answer that "do I feel safe" question. And so then what happens is the subconscious mind basically goes and it tugs on the shirt sleeve of the conscious mind. And it's like, hey, 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 hey. And the conscious mind is like, what do you want? Look, I'd rather be safe than sorry. And I can't decide fast enough if we feel safe. So I need you, conscious mind, to help me out. Mm. And the conscious mind rolls its proverbial eyes. Back to vision again.
Good one.
it rolls its eyes and it's like, oh, are you kidding me? Okay, fine. And then what happens is that the conscious mind now has to divert vision to making that threat assessment. And I describe that as looking everywhere and seeing nothing. Like a impulse sprinkler in the yard, the one that's got the giant metal spike, you jam it in the ground and the sprinkler goes as it scans left to right, right? That's a visual system that's looking everywhere but seeing nothing. Because it's scanning the environment, thinking, where's the next threat gonna pop out from? Where's it gonna be? Where's it gonna be? Where's it gonna be? Where's it gonna be? Well, and then let's not forget that when the conscious mind has to use all of our other sensory systems now to try to help out and answer that "do I feel safe" question, all of our other sensory systems now get pushed into DEFCON 1 status. Threat is imminent. So we're motion sensitive, we're sound sensitive, we're touch sensitive. The truth is we're taste and smell sensitive because all of our sensory systems are now pushed into fight or flight, high alert status. What I describe as survival attention. And I don't think it's a great stretch of the imagination that survival attention is going to trump learning attention 100% of the time.
Completely.
So I don't care how much you try to redirect somebody's attention back to learning, looking, and listening if their nervous system is stuck in fight or flight.
Yeah.
You can't do it. You'll spend your whole learning session just trying to redirect attention. And with that in mind, I'm going to jump analogies just a bit, but you'll see how they can. So here's one of my new favorite analogies. Imagine that you're looking at a 150-year-old barn where the roof is starting to collapse in the middle of the spine, right? If we're out in the countryside of Nebraska and up in the distance, we see one of these old farmhouses, the first thing that we would notice is the collapsing roof. And behaviorally, I'm saying that if we're looking at the roof level only, you'll get a diagnosis like ADHD, inattentive ADD, dyslexia, dyspraxia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, oppositional defiance, anxiety, panic, right? I mean, pick a label. Those sort of diagnoses are typically done at a behavioral level. Pretty classically, they're measures of performance as it comes to reading, writing, and math, or it's a checklist of behaviors if it's some component of panic, anxiety, or ADD, ADHD, right? Those are typically performance outcomes, behavioral observations, or behavioral checklists. Well, I'm saying maybe, just maybe, before we send in the roof repair crew, which could be prescription medication or other interventions, namely like maybe more math and reading instruction. Maybe before we send in the roof repair crew, we should contemplate, you know, well, what's supporting the roof? Oh yeah, there's the joists that underneath the roof that support it. Well, maybe the joists are falling apart.
Yeah.
And that's typically, in this learning context, it's typically rapid naming speed, phonological processing, and to some degree, working memory and executive function. Okay. But is there anything happening below the joist level? Yes. The joist got to be supported by the four walls. In this discussion, the four walls are eye focusing, eye tracking, eye teaming, motion processing. But the four walls got to be built on a foundation. Well, maybe the foundation's the problem related to polyvagal theory, primitive reflexes, archetype movements, millisecond timing clock, right? But maybe the reason that the foundation is falling apart is because we built it over sandy shifting soil that's built over an active fault line.
sounds fantastic.
which is epigenetics, minerals,
yeah,
microbiome, and inflammation, runaway inflammation at the cellular level.
Yeah. Which all circles back to minerals, as we know.
Right. So, but think about what does we just went from any of these diagnoses given to people at the roof level.
Yeah.
And taking it all the way down to the soil.
Yeah.
Because, and I've seen this, I see it almost every week, and I've been seeing it ever since I bought this practice, is that people are being treated at the roof level and then wonder why they're not getting better.
Completely. And we see this all the time too, from our understanding also, or at least I have, in totally different world of hormones and everything with the female body. It's what our society likes to do. Let's just fix the roof so then the house can keep looking pretty, because that's the only problem.
Well, which maybe we'd have better outcomes if the treatments at the roof level was actually helpful and beneficial, but it's not. Therein lies the rub.
Yeah. Because
if you only treat at the roof level, there's very few people that have good outcomes, because we're not getting to the soil level.
Well, and I can speak to this too, of like when they did the scotopic sensitivity testing and the color that was supposed to be supportive for me to be able to read was just simply doing purple overlays. And right. You know, at some point that wasn't addressing the actual core issue, was that I had significant mineral deficiencies from infancy that then manifested in a nervous system that was also stuck in a sympathetic state, and it was never going to address the problem. It's like just putting stucco on the outside of the house.
You know, I still, even though I've been doing this for a really long time, I still marvel every day about the power of this kind of optometry. As an example, I mean, and unless you're one of these people and have come to an office like mine and got to actually experience this, when I tell you these things, it's easy to be dismissive of it. I get that, but I know the reality of what I do because I do it every day.
Do you actually find that people are dismissive of it?
Well, only when I tell you what I'm going to tell you. Okay. And then you're like, Doug, no, you're making that up. That does not happen with the stuff that you're talking about. Well, I'm telling you, it does happen. Mm. So as an example, let me back the bus up for a second. If you want to know, you want to know how really easy my job is, I'll tell you. Anybody that walks in my front door, I've got to contemplate. Do I have something to offer them in terms of treatment, and what's that treatment going to look like? Well, classically, here's the contemplations. Can this problem be solved by surgery, medications, topically in the eye or by mouth, or lenses, or vision training, or do nothing? And then, of course, then we get into minerals and nutrition and microbiome, right? But pretty classically, it's surgery, medications, lenses, vision training, or do nothing. And do nothing isn't really a treatment. So then we're back to surgery, medication, lenses, vision training. And the things that we're talking about today, typically it's not a surgery or medication solution. So it's lenses or vision training. Huh. Oh, come on, that's pretty simple.
Yeah.
But the kind of lenses that I'm talking about aren't what people know. It's not just about nearsightedness, farsightedness, or astigmatism. It's way more than that. And for our purposes today, I would say, I'll just use the expressions like prism and or color, or something called low plus lenses. But prisms and color in particular, I can't tell you how big of a deal they are, because, mm-hmm. And here's some of the outcomes. So if I do the right kind of testing and do the right kind of assessment to get to a point where can I fit you in a pair of my lenses that's going to really improve your quality of life? Well, if I get the right combination of color and prism, it's going to get you to unclench your tight jaws.
Mm.
And maybe you don't need a bite guard anymore because you don't clench your teeth at night if you wear my glasses all day.
Yeah.
Or people that can barely turn their head to the left or right because their neck is so stiff. It's like somebody gave their cervical vertebrae a lube job, but we've done it with prism and color in a pair of lenses.
Mm.
Or somebody that's got wicked tight trigger points in their trapezius muscle, that goes away. Or I might stroke the palm of their hand and that makes them grit their teeth because it feels like walking into a spider web. And they're like, oof, I can barely have you do that. And then I'm like, well, if I stop, do you still feel it? And you're like, and sometimes when I stop stroking the palm of their hand, before I even have the chance to ask them, does it still feel itchy and do they want to rub their fingers? They've already rubbed their hand all over their body to get rid of that feeling.
Yeah.
And then I'll put on the color and the prism. And now that light stroking of their palm is not ticklish. And when I stop, it just feels like I've stopped.
Mm.
Or now when they look at print, they're like, I don't even notice the white lines anymore. In fact, I actually want to read the paragraph that you showed me because I can look at the words and letters on the page.
Yeah.
I've had people, this one gal from some years ago, she had had a stroke, probably in her late 60s, she had a stroke. And if I were to walk out in the hallway and listen, she dragged her left foot. So you could hear her gait coming down the hallway, right? She'd step quietly with her right foot and then she'd drag her left. Step with the right, drag your left. And that's what it sounds like when she walks.
Yeah.
Until I put my pair of glasses on and you can't hear her drag your left foot anymore.
So fascinating.
It's just, it's stunning.
Well, and for me, what I hear in all of this too, is the connection too, that so many people don't understand about the myofascia network. And that when we're able to get something that's so activated, like our visual cortex, that keeps us in those like overly tensed states, like we're carrying it all over our body. And we start to understand, I know from the work that I do from the pelvic bowl, especially, and getting all of that to actually like relax, because you have women with so much dysfunction and men and in humans in general, that then are creating problems in the knees and then in the calves. And so I start to wonder too, we were talking before we started recording about, I had compartmental syndrome when I was in high school, which is like carpal tunnel, but in your leg, and your calf is the biggest pump up to your heart. And if you have a block in your pelvis, then it's going to create this whole like cascade of effects that'll end up with things such as compartmental syndrome, because your body's unable to pump back up to the heart. And I'm curious how much that was actually connected to the visual cortex piece too, that kept me like hypertense.
Oh, bucket loads. Let me just bucket loads. Because reflexively, our nervous system at its, if we strip away really the conscious mind, our nervous system at its core is about protection and survival. Mm. Right? We want to survive to get to tomorrow. However, we have to get there, right? So, you know, and a classic example of reflexive behavior is someone that is experiencing sheer, true life-threatening terror will collapse to the floor and curl up in the fetal position and cry uncontrollably. Hmm. Or as an alternative, they'll pass out. Fight, flight, or freeze. Mm-hmm. Right? They pass out. That's about protection and survival. So as an example, one of the things I've learned over the years is I have something called an optokinetic drum. You've seen it. I think I've probably had it on one of our mineral courses. Probably. The black and white striped cylinder that spins.
Yeah.
Right? I can hold that on the wooden handle, and it's a cylinder about 8 inches in diameter and about 18 inches tall. And there's alternating black and white stripes that are about 3/4 of an inch in width around the whole cylinder. And if someone has the visual system that I'm referring to, they find that very difficult to look at. And it's typically worse if I slowly spin it one direction or the other. So what I've learned over the years, when I pull that out, I typically pull it out and simply say, is this comfortable or uncomfortable to look at? And I haven't spun it. They're like, I don't even want to look at it. Hmm. And if you're really annoyed by it, and I'm standing off to the side, I'll ask you that question and you'll turn and look at me and won't look at the stripes. Hmm. It's so annoying. We'll have a laugh about that, because they're like, Doug, I can't even look at the stripes. But if you do, where do you feel it? And then I tell them, here's your choices. Do you feel it in your eyes? Do you feel it in your head, your ears, your jaw, your throat, your chest, or your belly? Interesting. And if I'm really on my game, I'll say, do you feel a lump in your throat, a tightness in your chest, or a knot in your stomach? Hmm. I didn't make up that language. That's what people experience. And those are expressions that we use.
Yeah. Do you ever ask if they have a memory associated with that feeling in their body? Just out of curiosity, if it like triggers something that's being held onto energetically?
Well, yes and no. No, I think in the context that you're asking me the question, although now I'm going to have to incorporate that into my new questions.
Yeah, good. But, I would just be really curious to what's being stored on that, like in the memory level, that's creating that nervous system response.
Well, I would tell you that probably almost any patient that has any significant trauma history, there, I don't know that in the couple minutes that we would do this testing, I don't know that they would experience that flashback of a memory because they've gotten really good at burying it in their body.
Fair. Good point.
So, it wouldn't surprise me to some degree that those that find it Doug, I can't even look at those stripes. I could certainly believe that there is trauma that's buried in their tissue, and that's one way to resist bringing it out is I'm not even going to look at it because they can't articulate that if I would look at it for any length of time, these flashbacks are going to occur because I think their subconscious mind doesn't want to deal with the trauma history and they're just keeping it buried. Years ago, I did vision training with a family. Daughter was maybe 10. And while I was doing some testing with the daughter, I did some testing with the mom. Because I wanted to know the way the mom was using her two eyes together. And the testing device that I was using, let's say that the right eye sees a vertical white line and the left eye sees a horizontal white line. And the brain, if it's using the two eyes together, would stack the images together and make it look like a plus sign. Except she's only looking through one eye. Her brain has turned the other eye off.
Yeah.
And I had a little light box that's about the size of a deck of cards. And on the side of one of the sides, there's two tiny little LED lights. And when I turn it on, the LEDs rapidly flash back and forth, like about 12 times a second. And we can use flashing lights in this manner to break down suppression, right? So the fact that her brain's turning one eye off, this is the way this exchange went. I said, well, now you know that you're not looking through both eyes at the same time. And I'm gonna take my little light box and I show her the flashing lights. And I said, I'm gonna ask you to close your eyes and I'm gonna place the light box up to your eyes so that there's an LED close to each eye. I'm gonna turn the flicker on for about a minute and see if that will help your brain turn on both eyes. This is what I've described. And she's like, I'm not doing that. I'm like, whoa. There's clearly more to the story because it's the way in which you told me you're not going to do it. That spoke more to me than you telling me you're not going to do it. I'm like, what's that about? And she said, unless you want me on the floor in the fetal position, crying uncontrollably, I don't do flicker because it dredges up the abuse I went through as a kid. I'm like, fair enough. Okay, let's not do that then. So fast forward about 12 years later, she comes back. She's been a patient all throughout these years, but she calls me up one day and says, hey, I want to do vision therapy with myself. Kids are up and out of the house. It's just me and my husband at home. I've known about this vision problem I've had my whole life. I want to come and do vision training with you. And I think I texted you the expression the other day that said, what you are seeking is seeking you. Okay.
Probably.
It sounds like something we would talk about.
Yeah, it does.
So this mom reaches back out to me and truly about 6 weeks before that, I just finished reading a book about EMDR, eye movement desensitization and retraining.
Yeah.
And I've known, right, the circle of optometrists that I kind of travel around in, doing vision training and how it facilitates psychological healing frequently comes up.
Yeah.
So that's always been in the back of my mind. So I read this book about EMDR. I tell you the Flickr story from 12 years prior. She's called me up and saying, Doug, I want to do vision training with you. And so I say, oh, you made an impression on me 12 years ago when you said you didn't want to do the Flickr. So by any chance, do you know anything about EMDR? And she said, oh, I'm doing it with a therapist right now.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, well, okay. Well, you better go tell your therapist that you're going to start training with me. And I'm happy to talk to them if they'd like to. She told them. He had no context to understand what she was trying to convey. He never called me. She was maybe 3 or 4 sessions into doing therapy with me. And here was her description. She said, Doug, you know, if I was doing EMDR before I started doing work with you, if I was in the middle of a session and I could feel these memories start to come dredging up, if I wasn't in the mood that day to manage them, I would just basically stuff them back in the cedar chest and close the lid. Mm. And I'm like, okay, you know what you're telling me, right? You do have unresolved issues that's buried in your body.
Yeah.
She's like, yes, I know that. But I'm just telling you that if I didn't want to deal with it, I just close the lid on them. And then she said, I started doing this therapy with you, and these memories were on me in a flash.
Wow.
So did the vision training give her easier access to these memories? Arguably, yes. But it really threw her and her therapist off for several weeks because she was an emotional train wreck when all this stuff came dredging up. So I'm just going to say again, I'm so grateful and lucky to get to do what I do. It's going every day is an adventure going to work because I don't know who's going to show up and what I'm going to learn today and how I'm going to help somebody be a better version of themselves.
Yeah. And heal lifetimes of trauma that's stored in their tissues. That's the really amazing thing to me. And thank you for sharing all of that and for doing this work in the world. It's really beautiful, especially because I think it's a piece, in my opinion, that's really missing from the framework of everything. Our bodies are such beautiful, intricate ecosystems. And when we start to really understand the impact that our visual cortex is having on the rest of our body, and then how to like really be able to support that in our healing journey, because I don't know a single human on this planet that doesn't have some degree of trauma or some sort of, you know, whether or not they really want to touch it or address it, some sort of like physical maladaptive response to maintain homeostasis. And a lot of it is completely connected. And what's really fascinating to me too, is during these last, since April, almost a year now, like we're just 9 months or so of doing the RCP, I always had one of my eyes that was like slightly lazy. And as we know, like that's really connected to the saturated fat and retinol, vitamin A, deficiencies or imbalances, which is connected, like you're talking about, this sympathetic or parasympathetic nervous system responses. So as I've integrated more copper-rich sources, more retinol into my diet, the amount that eye is off has become increasingly less, which is fascinating. So we start to see that really important piece of being able to get our nervous system into a far more like flexible state, more towards that middle ground that isn't like oscillating, pendulum swinging either from dorsal to sympathetic.
Well, I also think that the vision things that we're talking about, really we can't talk about vision or the brain or vision and the brain because they're so intertwined, they're virtually the same thing. So I think in part, And it's why, let me circle back to, if you want to understand the whole person, you got to understand vision. If you want to understand vision, you got to understand the whole person. So yes, I think to a somewhat not particularly well understood or studied way, what some of the things that I see from a vision perspective are really representative of a brain on fire. It's runaway inflammation that's manifesting itself in part through the visual system when you look into that third circle.
Yeah.
And if I go back to my barn analogy, right, there's the soil level, minerals, microbiome, gut function, nutrition. And then the foundation level, which is vagus nerve, primitive reflexes, millisecond timing clock. And primitive reflexes, some of these primitive reflexes develop in utero. Some of them help you get delivered to the birth canal. Some of them help babies learn how to roll over on their stomach, lift their head up off the floor, get up into a position where they're sitting back on their haunches in preparation for crawling and then getting about 2 feet, right? Much of this behavior is reflexively driven, right? We've got software programs that come preloaded in our brainstem that says, oh, you're human? You should exhibit these behaviors along these sort of developmental timelines, and they should just happen automatically in preparation for you getting to a point where you can do higher order motor skills, that you can skip, you can gallop, you can do jumping jacks, you can ride a bike, and so on and so forth. Ultimately, with the idea that you can have hand dexterity, good auditory motor control, visual motor control, and ultimately vocal motor control, right? These are all motor skills.
Yeah.
Well, for any variety of reasons, if your reflexes don't become integrated into your neurology, they become a stumbling block for you not being able to develop the abilities to move, look, and listen in a fast, accurate, effortless, sustainable, age-appropriate, meaningful way.
Yeah.
And I've seen this too many times where maybe somebody does vision training at another office that doesn't pay attention to the reflexes. And those skills might have gotten better when they were doing the therapy. And maybe they got better to a point where it's like, oh, look, your skills are good. We can let you go now. And let's say 9 or 10, 12 months later, somebody stumbles on me and they come in and see me. I'm like, you did vision training? Because when I measure your skills, it's like you've done nothing. Mm. And invariably, it's that they still got nutrition issues.
Yeah.
And mineral issues and reflex issues and millisecond timing clock issues. So it's like we tried to repair the four walls without addressing the foundation in the soil.
Yeah, which is the part that I think is really important to bring up here in this conversation, since this will be the first that a lot of people listen to, is that when a lot of these things are first integrated into the human body is in the last weeks in utero, when we are downloaded with 10% of our mother's mineral content, to say nothing about whatever trauma she might have endured throughout the time that we were in utero, while we're sitting right up against her vagus nerve and being downloaded with all of those sensations. That's that true. We then come out and start from that place. And I mean, as we've seen that, which we've done to humans now for quite a while with the addition of iron fortification from the 1940s and then up in the 70s, and then talk about glyphosate and all of the damage that that's wreaked on all of our systems. You know, it makes sense that then people would be struggling to the degree that they are, and that all cause mortality is on a rise. You know, over every single year.
That's true. And I think a good example of that, for 5, 6, 8, 10 different reasons, I see a lot more kids today that have retained primitive reflexes than I did my first 10 years in practice.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's rampant. There's I can't even tell you the last time that I've seen a kid who had an IEP or a 504 plan at school for whatever qualifying reason. They, I'm telling you, that pretty much to a kid, they all have retained primitive reflexes.
Wow. And can you explain that in like simple terms in case somebody doesn't know what that means?
Well, yes. So remember, primitive reflexes or reflexes in general are representative of involuntary behavior. Mm. And our nervous system is about protection and survival.
Mm-hmm.
So if your quote unquote reflexes aren't integrated, you're hobbled in your ability to access, develop, and use your abilities to move, look, and listen, which then lends itself, at least from a school perspective, that you're likely to struggle more with learning how to read, write, and do math. And then you start falling further behind. Well, the problem in this context is that in too many cases, from an academic standpoint, if you're having trouble, for example, learning how to read, the I'm telling you, for the most part, the thinking is, oh, well, clearly you're not doing enough reading. You need more reading instruction. Well, let me just tell you that invariably never works. And I think it's, I don't think this is an overstatement. I think it's abusive.
Yeah.
Because all you're doing is re-traumatizing that child who's not benefiting from the reading instruction that his or her peers are benefiting from. So why on God's green earth would we think that if you weren't benefiting from the original curriculum that we were providing you, why do we think that providing you with more of the same is going to work any better?
While we serve you highly processed foods that keep your nervous system in a sympathetic state. That was such a good like mic drop. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so there you go.
So good. I could talk to you for probably a good hour and a half more, but I think that we should probably at least close out this first one.
Yeah, wonderful.
First of all, thank you so much. Can you share with all of our listeners where they can find you if they're interested in walking this path of doing vision training or working with you specifically?
Yeah. So the simplest way to find a little bit more about me, you can look at my website, steffioptometry.com. So S is in Sierra, T is in Tango, E is in Echo, P is in Papa, H is in Hector, E is in Echo, Y is in Yankee, steffioptometry.com.
And all of this will be down in the show notes too.
And my website is just a springboard to help you learn more things. And at the very least, you can find my email address and you can email me. And if you want more to read, believe me, nobody ever accuses me of not sending them enough things to read.
As I can attest to.
And I read a lot. And so I have lots of things to share.
It's impressive. It is impressive.
Well, thank you. This was fun. This was a lot of fun. Thank you for having
yes.
me.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Dove. I really appreciate all of your time and your knowledge and for what you're doing in this world to help so many individuals.
And there we have it. Ending of episode number one here on the Paris Hodges podcast. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Doug. Never ceases to amaze me all of the correlations and ways that our body has adapted over time and these imbalances that manifest in order to keep us in a space of homeostasis. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Doug, I've linked his information below in the show notes. And until next time, take care.